Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, is it time we just all admitted that free banking, well, isn't really free anyway, and started paying for our own accounts? Worried parents are wondering how they'll cover Labour's planned VAT on private school fees should they win the election. This Is Money helps one diligent saver work out how to find an advisor that they can trust. And Crane is back on the case and helping one reader who was sold a car by Cinch with a pretty significant fault. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, most of us don't pay to have a bank account. Obviously, some do to get bits on the side. But this free if in credit banking model in the UK is a market and commercial decision and not a regulatory requirement other than for basic bank accounts. That was a point repeated recently by the boss of the Financial Conduct Authority, who said that the regulator would not stand in the way of banks opting to charge customers to hold accounts. But why would they do this, and what would it mean for us? Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Helen. Firstly, Simon, the current model of free if in credit banking.
I thought it was very lucky that the boss of the FCA said he wouldn't stand in the way of banks charging for current accounts, considering numerous banks already charge for current accounts.
Yeah.
It would be a bit of an issue if he said, I stand in the way of banks charging for current accounts, and then had to go, oh, yeah, some of them already do, wouldn't it? But what this was it was seen as signalling the green light for the end of free banking. Mm. Now, I would add one massive caveat to this. In a well-worn phrase, this is not our first rodeo on free banking. We have been here before, okay? We've been round and round and round this, including, you know, many more years ago than I would care to recall it actually was, because it doesn't feel like that long ago, but it was probably ages, around the time of the bank charges scandal, when the banks were hauled over the coals for charging their customers astronomical sums of money for going into unauthorized overdrafts. Unauthorized overdrafts were something that your bank let you go into, but it was unauthorized because they would give you some money that you shouldn't have and then charge you a whacking great fee for allowing you to do that and some interest on top. And it was a massive money spinner for the banks. And then there was a big campaign to stop it. And also a campaign saying that under the Unfair Terms and Conditions Act, or so, I can't remember, gosh, I could have reeled this off the top of my head once upon a time. Under the law, this was illegal. And the banks were challenged on this. And the banks lost. And then the banks appealed. And then the banks won. And then the banks were challenged again. And then they lost. And then they finally appealed again. And unfortunately, they did win eventually. But the upshot was a stamping down on some of that unfair practice. At that time, big debate, well, the problem is because we have free banking. And to go back to your question, the current model is bank accounts carry the illusion of being free. You don't pay for the account itself. You don't pay to take money out. You don't pay for lots of the other things that people in other countries do have to pay for. I must admit, when I was in Australia and I had an Australian bank account, I was absolutely shocked that you had to pay to take money out of the machine, or you were only allowed a certain amount of free withdrawals. I was used to the British system. But what the British system was also doing at that time was facilitating a scenario where the banks would sting you in other ways for it. And that period was the late 1990s, early 2000s, at which point banks were merrily doing the bank charges racket, flogging people useless PPI, and there were a lot less controls on the kind of cross-selling that they could do with other products. Now, some of those things have been stamped down on, and retail banking has become a much less profitable endeavor, but it is still worth your bank attracting you as a customer and offering you a free current account due to the cross-selling opportunities that it offers it. So it could pick you up as a savings account customer, and it can probably get away with paying you a lower savings rate than it needs to if it was to go and pick up a savings account customer on the open market. You've opened that savings account with your bank because it's easy. So it makes a bit of money on the net interest margin there. It can sell you a mortgage, and could probably sell you a mortgage at a slightly higher rate than it would have to if it was going to go out and compete on the open market. Makes a little bit of extra money on the net interest margin there. It could flog you some insurance. Again, probably make a little bit more money on that insurance than it would have to do if it went out on the open market. Could flog you a personal loan. Could flog you a credit card. Could flog you a paid for bank account. And can just look at you in terms of lifetime customer value. And what your bank is doing is saying, this person's lifetime customer value is greater than the cost of us giving them the free bank account. The FCA is saying, that's probably not the best way to operate, and maybe we should charge people. But people resolutely in this country do not want to be charged for their bank accounts en masse.
We don't, but then we didn't like being charged for other things like plastic bags. And yes, we're using them less, but we suck it up eventually, don't we? But is this going to be a case of that this is a green light for banks to charge for all those other things that you said, a bank account, taking money out, but it's not going to benefit us in any other way, is it? It's not like they're going to go, oh, all right, then we're going to reduce charges somewhere else because that's fair. Helen?
Exactly. I think in reality, you know, as you said, banks can already charge customers for current accounts if they want. But if this is going to happen en masse, you know, one bank is going to have to take the plunge and be the first to charge their basic current account customers. And I don't think, and you know, no bank wants to be the first one to do that because they're going to lose customers. And if you look at over the last couple of years, all these cash bungs that they've been paying to people to switch their current accounts to them, they're clearly still very keen to get in new customers. So I think, you know, it's not going to look good on whichever bank first decides to do this. And I think they're honestly all just going to be a bit too scared to take the plunge, if I'm honest. As you said, it's, you know, we're very used to having free bank accounts in this country. You know, people, as it's going to be free for basic accounts. I think that's protected. These are the accounts where, you know, you can't get an overdraft. They're the very, you know, essentially just cash accounts. But yeah, you're right. We're not used to paying for bank accounts in this country. And I think it's going to be difficult for people to get on board with it, especially at a time when the services that banks provide are actively getting worse. If you look at the amount of bank branches that are closing and things like that, you know, people will say, and I think quite rightly, why should we pay for this when, you know, my local branch down the road is closed and I can't go there anymore? Why should I pay for my current account now, when the service that my bank provides to me is getting worse and not better?
I went, and bear with me on this one, I went to get my ears checked the other day. Apparently I have selective hearing. There's nothing wrong with my hearing, it's just selective. And it was free. And I didn't like that. I think for two reasons. One, it sort of diminishes the, I don't know, they're called audiologists, job. I'm sure they've trained very hard for that role. But it's a bit like optometrists as well. What are you trying to sell me? And when it comes to my health, I don't want you to be selling me something that I may not necessarily need or a bit of an upgrade. I'd quite happy just pay you up front, be transparent. If I need something, I feel like genuinely I need it. Simon, transparency.
Yeah. And there's a lot to be said for that. Transparency. And there's a lot to be said for that line where if you're not paying, then, you know, you're the product. There's no such thing as a free lunch and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, we are where we are. And as you said, the banks aren't going to stop cross-selling to you. They're not going to stop the ingrained practice of sticking people on legacy savings accounts that pay pitiful rates not being absolutely the best on insurance. And you might get lucky. You might find that your bank actually does offer one of the best savings rates at any given time. You might find that your bank does offer one of the best mortgage products or insurance products. But you also should definitely compare these things, because ultimately loyalty doesn't really pay that much in the banking sense. They don't do that much for us. And we remember having this argument with you many times before about loyalty, and I'd said about loyalty, you know, about like, look, if you like your bank, then stick with it, you know, you don't have to switch. And but you know, so what you're going to do is you're going to end up with a scenario where our banks going to change their spots, probably not. Are they just going to start charging you a few pounds a month as well as doing that, all that other stuff? Yes, that's probably the case. And I also think that the issue with this is that probably the regulator, if it was honest, would quite like us to shift to a point where we were all paying for our bank accounts and banks were doing less cheeky stuff that they might need to get slapped over the wrist for. Okay. It would make the FCA's life easier for a start. Right. And it would probably be more transparent and it would probably be fairer. Are they actually going to do that? Is that actually going to be enforced? Probably not. I highly doubt it. And are they all going to do this together? Because the only way you do this is you say to banks, you have to charge for the account, because otherwise I guarantee you that a couple of them will break ranks and go, well, we're not going to charge. Because they'll scoop up a load of customers off the back of it. And they'll go, the customer lifetime value is worth way more to us than the cost of doing that. And there are banks that have started to charge. They do it for their packaged accounts. There are some that have experimented with doing it for just standard accounts, but they haven't really done very well. And I think what's really interesting here and tells you everything you need to know is that the challenger banks who have come up, you know, the digital challenger banks that arguably offer a better digital banking experience in a field where we are absolutely 100% used to paying for subscriptions, have not really properly pursued the charging for a bank account model. Okay. Starling, that account is free. Monzo's standard account is free. Now, Monzo has gone down the route of charging people. You can sign up to Monzo Premium for £15 a month. You can have banking that makes a statement. Turn heads with our white metal card. Enjoy peace of mind with phone and worldwide travel insurance, interest on your balance, and much more. Monzo Premium is £15 per month, 6 month minimum, must be aged 18 to 69, T's and C's apply. Is that worth signing up for? I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I think the white metal card is a gimmick.
Do you think?
Yeah, I'm gonna take it on the chin here from the Monzo maniacs who wade in and attack me. I think that white metal card is a gimmick.
Right.
Okay? I don't see any practical use for it. If you've got a practical use for your white metal Monzo card, if you've got a legal practical use for your white metal Monzo card, get in touch. Don't tell exactly. us if it's illegal. But enjoy peace of mind with phone and worldwide travel insurance, interest on your balance and much more. You could get that stuff elsewhere. I don't know whether Monzo's phone and worldwide travel insurance is better for the same price than just taking out an insurance policy. I do know that a lot of people will end up having travel insurance anyway and probably having their phone covered under personal possessions on their home insurance, which they're going to have. And interest on your balance, again, you're probably better off just getting the best savings account. So to be honest, I'm not interested in paying the £15 a month for that. And I'm not interested in paying for any other package bank account either. And whilst I can see the merits in charging for bank accounts, I don't pay for mine. I just pay for it in kind.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I think that the package bank accounts are the things that really get me. It's sort of like you're tagging on a load of oftentimes useless rubbish you could get somewhere else just to charge. But people seemingly like them, so there you go. Simon, I do want to ask you just really briefly, because you mentioned there about challenger banks. You've got an article on your website. Do Virgin Money and Tesco bank deals signal the end of the road for the original challenger banks? Do they?
Well, as discussed last week on the podcast, a bit of that challenger bank Virgin Money is actually Northern Rock.
Well, yes, that's true.
one of our readers said in the comments that they thought it was outrageous that Richard Branson was being paid all this money off the back of this deal if it goes through, and that actually it should be given to the Northern Rock shareholders who were wiped out You'd have to obviously trace that back. It's interesting because this is the kind of first wave of challengers. Virgin is in that. Virgin was a rebrand of... Well, Virgin's a really weird story. There's like loads of like buyouts and rebrands that have gone in there. It includes the old Clydesdale and Yorkshire Bank in there that then rebranded itself as like CYK or something like that. And Tesco, again, the supermarket banking thing was at one point seen as the future of banking. Tesco bought out its joint venture with RBS for quite a lot of money. And it was seen as a great deal for Tesco at the time because Tesco had the opportunity to really go after banking customers because it had all those stores, all the details and all those customers, all the club card stuff and everything like that. Went big into the mortgage market. That didn't really pay off. I mean, to be honest, maybe if it had gone into the mortgage market now, it would have paid off better because rates are higher, whereas it was in the mortgage market when rates are lower. And yeah, it's that's fizzled out as well. Sainsbury's Bank fizzled out as well. I think it just illustrates that retail banking is not the most lucrative or easiest thing to get involved in nowadays. In the early 2000s, it was a license to print money. Mm-hmm. I mean, because they were ripping people off left, right and center. I mean, I nearly got missold PPI when I was a student, on top of a loan that I was definitely missold when I just needed to extend my overdraft because I accidentally reversed my car into a pillar in a car park. I only needed £400. And basically, I ended up with a graduate loan. And then they tried to sell me some PPI on the top of it. They were like, have you considered what would happen if you couldn't repay this loan? I was like, well, I can't repay the loan now. And they were like, well, I mean, if you couldn't keep up with the payments. I was like, you've just sold me a graduate loan. I don't have any payments right now. I don't have any payments till I graduate. They're like, have you considered what would happen if you lost your job and couldn't pay it after that? Like, I don't have a job yet. You know, so I luckily didn't take the PPI. But, you know, there was this stuff going on left, right and centre. And at that point, retail banking looked like a great gig, a great racket to get into. It doesn't look quite so profitable anymore.
So in sum, just to end this one, whatever the boss of the FCA says, green lights or not, this is not changing anytime soon.
Well, may I introduce you to the poll on our website? Would you pay a monthly fee to use a current account? We've currently had about 3,500 people vote on this. Yes, I would pay a fee is currently scoring a whacking great 5%. Wow. Versus no, which is romping ahead at 95%. So tough task here. Yeah. on the FCA and the bank's hands, I think.
All right, then, moving on. Now, Labour has made it pretty clear that if they win the next election, it's planning a VAT raid on private school fees. The party has pledged to remove the charitable status of independent schools, resulting in fees being hit with 20% VAT, among other changes. Now, that's fine, I imagine, for the super wealthy to suck it up. But for many parents, it could be the straw that breaks the camel's back of affordability. So what will they do? You have a letter from your reader, Helen, firstly. People might be surprised that independent schools can have a charitable status. Just explain that, if you would.
This is something that people are often outraged about. And on the face of it, you can understand that. Of course, a lot of people who go to private schools, not everyone, a lot of people, though, are very, very privileged. You know, you have to be generally a kind of certain level of wealth to be able to attend a private school. But the reason that they're able to be registered charities is essentially that they say that they do things for the local community in exchange for the money that they make. So they'll perhaps have scholarships. So people who otherwise couldn't afford to go to the school will be able to go. They might share their facilities, so sports grounds, libraries, swimming pools, things like that, with children from local state schools, and, you know, run other to do other sort of good deeds in the community. Now, obviously, whether you think that's worth kind of having all the benefits that come with charity status is the question. But that is the way that they currently justify it.
So removing the charitable status will mean that they'll have to pay VAT. That will presumably be passed on to parents, and there are other changes as well related to business rates and all that. You have a reader question. What have they said?
Yes, so as you said, this is a long-standing Labour pledge to remove charitable status from private schools. The biggest impact of that for parents who send their kids to these schools is that private school fees would be hit with 20% VAT. They would also lose relief on business rates. So the fees paid by parents presumably would go up because the schools would pass on those costs. So this reader, they have two children in private school. One's in the first year of secondary school and one is in the third year. They don't want to move them. One of them is sort of been there for a few years. They feel it's unfair to take them away from their friends and school they're used to, which is fair enough. The other one has some special needs and they feel like it would be really sort of troublesome for her if she had to leave the school, which is all fair enough. But they're wondering essentially how they're going to manage that extra VAT. So based on the fees that they pay for their children, which is around £36,000 a year, that's going to cost them an extra £7,200. So no insignificant amount. And they're essentially wondering how they can manage those fees and keep their two children in the school. And one thing they've identified is that they have quite a lot of equity in their home. So it's worth £900,000. But they've paid off the majority of that and their mortgage at the moment is only £300,000 and they've got 15 years left to pay. They've got a remortgage deadline coming up this year. They're coming off a five-year fix and they're going from 1.5% currently to 4.5%. So their payments are going up quite a lot. That's about £800 a month. However, the fact that they've got to this remortgage point, they're wondering whether they could take out some equity from their home and stash that away in order to make up the extra amount on the school fees. They're thinking that perhaps they could take it out, put it in a savings account and then use it over the years to top up that extra money that they need to keep their children in that school. So they're going to be paying more, you know, their rates go up anyway. And obviously by remortgaging, presumably to a lower loan to value, they're going to be paying more whatever happens, but they're thinking, could this be a strategy that enables them to keep their kids in the school, which is their sort of financial priority?
And so?
So yes, the answer is that is absolutely something that they can do. We spoke to a couple of experts and they said, yes, on paper, that is possible. However, it's going to cost them a lot of money. So their mortgage payments just based on their new rate alone are going to go from about £1,800 to £2,300. If they add that extra £150,000 onto the mortgage, that would take their monthly payments to almost £3,500 a month. So the first thing they obviously need to consider is, can they afford this? Mm. If they can't, clearly they shouldn't do it. But if there's that, if they can make those repayments, there are a few things they can do to kind of make it a bit easier on them or maybe slightly reduce them. So they could perhaps look at extending the mortgage term a bit. That would obviously they need to pay for longer and then end up paying more interest, but that would cut down the payments a bit in the short term. They could perhaps look at, instead of fixing for 2 or 5 years, they could fix for maybe a longer term, 10 or 15 years, which would mean that there'd be no kind of surprises along the way. They've got this money for the school fees and they know that that's going to be there until their kids finish school. The obvious downside of that is that mortgage rates might go down and their loan will start to look quite expensive. There are other options. So they could look at an offset mortgage, which is when you get a sort of slightly lower rate in exchange for having a lot of money in a savings account, which is linked to the mortgage. And you can then sort of draw that money down and no interest is charged on money that isn't then drawn down. So there are some options that they have. Also, if they were to put the money in a savings account, they could then earn interest on that, which would add in sort of extra money to the school fees pot. However, they'd obviously have to be careful about what tax they were being charged on that interest. So I think the conclusion is from our experts, you know, it's going to be expensive, but if that is their financial priority, then they can afford the mortgage repayments. It can be done.
Simon, you know, surely if you're sending your kids to private school, you can afford it. How much are you hearing from parents who are concerned about this right now?
Okay, so we don't hear a huge amount from parents who are concerned about this, but we do hear some grumbling. I mean, I, amongst my friends, know people who send their children to private school and people who don't send their children to private school, okay? And, I mean, I don't send my children to private school, just to be clear. The people who are sending their children to private school tend to be very much up the upper end of the income scale and often two earners up the upper end of the income scale. And the thing I would say is private school is astronomically expensive nowadays. So the scenario in this is that the person is two children, 18 grand a year each on school fees, right? 36 grand a year on school fees. That's an entirely conceivable scenario. It's slightly above the average, but the average gets dragged down by, you know, by some schools. That's probably like a reasonable case scenario. £36,000 a year, right? So for most parents paying that, you would have that would be £70,000 of pre-tax income, roughly, maybe slightly less. Okay. So that's 70 grand that out of a salary to pay that. And that shows you why private schools have actually become more elitist over the last 20 years. Because if you look at the inflation on school fees, it's way, way above inflation, way above inflation, way above wage inflation, and so on. So the problem that we have is actually that our private school system has become more elitist compared to 20 years ago, 30 years ago, where if someone went to private school, obviously there were, you know, very rich people there, very rich families, but then you would be more likely to have people further down, you know, the kind of income scale, not low down the income scale, but the kind of middle classes. I think that the middle classes sending their kids to private school has been very much killed off now, unless they have a very good reason for wanting to do it. One of which will be, you know, they just feel that they should do that because, you know, their parents did it for them or something like that. Or the schools where they live are not very good and they see it as the only real option. Or there's a specific reason that they feel the need to send their child there. And that's touched upon in this because, you know, you're looking at children at the moment who didn't go to school for, what, a year and a half? The damage that that has done to children is immense, okay? Really, really immense. I don't think we really appreciate, you know, quite how much damage that has done, because children thrive on kind of, you know, the routine and understanding how life works and everything. And all of a sudden they were told, you can't leave the house, you can't go to school, you can't see any other members of your family, you can't touch anyone. Like, how much that scares children. So there are lots of parents at the moment who are sending their kids to school because their kids have got real problems, okay? You know, and off the back of that, whilst I can 100% understand the argument that stop claiming private schools were a charity and that they should be VAT exempt because of it, I don't agree with Labour's plan. Because I think that if they did it all of a sudden, and they might not do it all of a sudden, they might graduate in or something like that, I think what it harms is it harms children. And it's going to end up with parents, you know, pulling their children out of school, moving their children to schools, or having to, you know, desperately try to find the money on top of the very, very high fees that they're trying to find. And it will, you know, lead to more problems in families, all that kind of stuff. And the people who won't be affected by this are the really rich people, for whom proportionately it's much less of an issue. And it will only serve to make private schools more elitist rather than less elitist. And the other reason why I think we shouldn't charge VAT on private schools is because it's education and you shouldn't charge VAT on education. You know, it should just be exempt. But, you know, rightly or wrongly, it does look like this is going to come in. And private school fees are astronomically expensive, and there will be parents who just make it work, because you always read these stories. And the last thing parents ever want to do is take their children out of school. You read these stories of people, how they're really, really struggling, even despite their high incomes. And, you know, the mortgage has gone up, the bills have gone up, they feel like they're living on the breadline and everything. And then in it says, and our children, we just don't want to take the children out of private school. And you're like, come on, guys, that's like 36 grand a year. That would make the difference. But you can understand why people don't want to do it. What's interesting here, though, is also the fact that you can see how people are thinking about protecting themselves against this. But actually, it's more expensive to do this on a yearly basis than it is to just find the VAT. So what you'd have to be doing is finding more money to cover the mortgage payments than you would do to just pay the school fees. So you would think it's a completely illogical move. But what people would be doing is borrowing the money and then having that money in a pot, and then they can use that to help themselves pay the mortgage. And then also there's the, can you get a bit back in savings? But I do think we're going to see more and more of this stuff. And if it does get brought in, then I think we will see a lot more questions from readers.
All right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now for our weekly Investing Explained series by David Kell, a financial planner from Charles Stanley Direct. David, welcome to the podcast. We've got a reader question here. I've got £3,000 to invest. How should I decide whether to put it in my ISA or my pension?
It's a good question, because pensions and ISAs, they're great products to save for the future. They've both got their advantages and disadvantages. What might be best for somebody will depend on their individual circumstances and their goals. Just to sort of narrow it down a little bit, and some relevant factors which would take part in the decision making is whether it's for short term, medium or long term goals. You've got to bear in mind that you'll not be able to access the pension until you turn 55, and that changes to 57 from the 6th of April 2028. Short term, ideally, should be cash. Medium term could be stocks and shares ISA, and then the longer term outlook should be pensions. Other things you've got to take into account is your age, your health, what income tax bracket you're in, and the contribution amounts as well. So as much as you're looking to contribute £3,000, have you got enough allowance left? Because you're allowed to contribute £60,000 to a pension per year, or if you're earning less than this, you're restricted to 100% of earnings, and you can do £20,000 into an ISA, which can be split between cash and stocks and shares. However, you've got a £3,000 contribution into an ISA is going to cost you £3,000. A contribution of £3,000 to a pension would result in a contribution of £3,750 into the pension pot. And if you're a high rate or an additional rate taxpayer, you can claim back a further 20% or 25% from the tax return. There's always an option to contribute smaller amounts as well to both. So you've got a well-rounded savings strategy for your different goals, depending whether they are short, medium or long term.
And is it important for someone to do this before the end of the tax year, which is looming?
It is important to plan to maximise the ISA allowances, particularly if you're going to maximise them anyway in the next year and you've got some remaining allowance available. Particularly on the ISAs, it's important because it's either use it or lose it. With regards to pensions, you have got a little bit more flexibility because you are able to carry forward pension allowances from the previous three tax years. However, if you're looking to reduce your income tax bill for the current tax year, contribution will need to be made in that same tax year.
David, very comprehensive. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. A good financial advisor can be worth their weight in gold. A bad one can cost you the earth. But how do you find a good one? You have a reader question from someone in a fortunate financial position, Helen, but they want to know where they go from here. So tell me more about this.
They're very fortunate indeed. So they have, well, not are they fortunate or have they just worked hard? I shouldn't say they're just lucky. They've worked very hard. They've built up £850,000 in cash savings, as well as £150,000 in single company shares. So they have a £1 million pot at their disposal. They've also paid off their mortgage. But they don't know if they're doing the best with their money. They don't know if their money's working as well as it could be for them. So they're looking at potentially getting some financial advice. Good idea. However, their problem is that they say they have a big trust issue around people, money, and the fact that they don't understand the financial advisor's fees. So they want some help with financial planning. They want to know who to go to, how they can work out their trustworthy, and how much they're going to cost, essentially. And it's quite a common question, I think. You know, a lot of people don't necessarily think about getting financial advice perhaps until, you know, they're looking towards retirement or thinking about things like inheritances. I think, you know, you might think, oh, you've got £1 million. Well, why have you never sort of taken advice on this before? But I think it's quite understandable. You know, he's just been building up his pot and he's now thinking, oh, actually, what should I do with all this? Am I kind of utilising it in the best way? So we went to a couple of experts and asked for their advice on how to choose a financial advisor that you can trust with your money. And their advice was quite interesting. So first of all, they said that clearly you need to go to an advisor that's regulated by the FCA. That means they've completed all the right qualifications. So that's the baseline. But they also talked about more sort of emotional things. So they said you want to find someone that you can get on with and, you know, you enjoy spending time with and you feel that you have a bit of a rapport and you know they're going to do what's right for you, which I think is actually quite important. And, you know, that can be important in all kinds of, people that you hire to help you with finances, things like, you know, a mortgage broker or, a solicitor. It's, you know, it always helps and makes things a bit easier, especially having kind of tough conversations if you have someone who you just think is quite a nice person. The other things they said, look at specialisms. So if you have a particular financial problem that you want to address. So I think one of the things this person was interested in is looking at his investments and whether they were sort of in the right places, how much risk he was kind of exposed to. So it's just to perhaps look at someone who is an investment specialist, financial advisor, which makes complete sense. And the final thing they said was to ask around. So ask your friends, family, you know, if someone you know can recommend a good financial advisor that they've had a good experience with, then, you know, that's often the best sort of recommendation, isn't it? You know, a firsthand, backing of the person you're going to trust with your money. So, yeah, some good advice there, I think.
Some people might think, Simon, that, wow, this person's amassed a million. I mean, they're obviously fairly sensible with their money and know what they're doing. And others would say, gosh, do you need to have a million to have a financial advisor?
To which the answer to your second question is no, but a financial advisor will charge you. In the old days, financial advisors just used to take commission on your investments, but it was decided that was a bad move because it encouraged financial advisors, or it potentially incentivized financial advisors to not do the right thing by their clients. So something called RDR stopped that some years ago. So now you do need to pay a financial advisor. You could pay them either in a cash lump sum, you could pay them in annual fees that are a percentage of your portfolio, or you could do it in a mix of both of those things. And I would be wary in a scenario like this of paying annual percentage fees on the total value of the portfolio, because is your advisor going to have to do work that is multiple amounts of work more and justified in paying for to sort out your £1 million rather than your £200,000? Potentially, arguably not. Okay, so watch out for the fees. And then when you do speak to an advisor, as Helen said, try to get a feel for them. Do you like them? And don't feel obligated to go with them. The thing is, you'll get an appointment with them. They'll ask you to provide lots of financial details. You give them lots of financial details. This first appointment should be free. They'll talk you through stuff. And then you're there. And probably that financial advisor is going to be looking at the scenario that by the time they've got you to that point, the chances of you signing up with them are really quite high because you've made that kind of commitment. And once we've made a commitment to someone like that, we very rarely walk away and go, I'm not going to buy it. But you have to be willing to do that. Okay. Think about it like buying a car, right? You got to go, or a sofa. You got to go check that out properly. You got to go sit on the sofa. You got to go sit in the car. You got to go drive the car. The car might be a perfectly good car. The sofa might be a perfectly good sofa. But if it is not right for you as a driver and an owner, or for your bottom as a sofa, then you move on and you choose something else, okay? And a financial advisor is not just for sitting on or driving, but you do have to take the same principle with the financial advisor as well and say, you know, this person is not right for me. I just don't click with this person, you know? Maybe a better analogy would have been like a job interview or something like that, but who knows?
I was going to say, please don't go into a financial advisor's office and start sitting on them or other sorts of things.
Well, my understanding is that along with selling investments based on commission, encouraging clients to sit on your lap is no longer considered a good move for financial advisors. But look, you don't have to have that much money. You could start with much less, but the fees that you were going to pay will be a larger proportion of the money that you've got. But you might get a better outcome out of it. And, you know, some financial advice firms and financial planners will demonstrate to you what benefit they think you can get from taking financial planning. So there will be the cost savings, and some of those, they can, you know, those are concrete. They can work those out for you based on your existing investments. They can say, I can save you money here, here, and here. Then there's the potential extra gains from encouraging better financial behavior. And then there are also the tax planning issues. And actually, tax planning can be worth far more to you than just being in a slightly different investment fund. And also, to go back to the point about if somebody's built up 850 grand in cash and £150,000 in company shares, they're clearly doing pretty well. Do they need a financial advisor? Well, arguably, their returns could be considerably better if they didn't have way more cash than they need. You should have a rainy day fund that covers you for 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. It's a good idea to have some cash on top of that. Cash pays 5% at the moment, so that's a decent return. But the best long-term inflation-beating returns come from investing, not from holding cash. And it might be the case that if this person had had a financial advisor 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that they could trust and did the right thing by them, they might now have £2 million instead of £1 million. Number made up on the spot.
Quite.
Past, yeah, no, past performance, all those kind of warnings. Don't sit on your financial advisor's lap.
Yeah. Great tip at the end there, Simon. Great. Finally, Crane is back on the case. Talking of cars, this time she's helping a reader who bought a car on Cinch but discovered the bonnet wouldn't open. 3 months later, it's still not fixed. Now, I'm no car expert, Helen, but I'm pretty confident one needs the bonnet to open. But firstly, Cinch, explain what that is.
I'm also not a car expert, but let's do our best. I think I know what a bonnet is, and I know that it needs to open. So we're in a good position.
Excellent. Good start.
So Cinch is one of these online used car companies. Their model is essentially they will buy the car from the person who wants to sell it, and they will sell it on to the next customer, obviously with a bit of markup. So this reader got in touch with me. They had bought a car from Cinch back in November. They'd met the agent who'd sold it to them at a pickup point to collect it. All good so far. But when they picked up the car, they obviously took a look around it, checked that everything was working properly, and they found out that something wasn't working properly, which was this issue with the bonnet. So the lever in the by the driver's seat to open the bonnet didn't work, which means the bonnet didn't open. Quite a big problem. So obviously, and this was a lady who bought the car with her partner. She was pregnant, so it's quite a stressful time. She was obviously reluctant to accept the car. She said, you know, doesn't work, not really sure about this. But she really needed a car to get around. She'd been without a car for a few weeks, and the salesman said, oh, it's really easy to deal with Cinch. They'll be great. They'll get it sorted in absolutely no time. So she was like, okay, fine. Clearly, by the fact that she ended up getting in touch with me, we know that that didn't happen. So she got in touch with Cinch, basically straight away said, look, this has happened. You saw it's a broken car. Please, can you fix it? And the long and short of it is that for 3 months, she went constantly back and forth with them. Can I book an appointment at a garage? Yes, we'll book you one. Then the appointment never materialised. Other times she got a call from a garage saying, where's your car? We thought you'd bring it in. And Cinch hadn't told her that an appointment had been booked.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, really frustrating. Obviously, this is stressing her out. She's getting more and more heavily pregnant. Not the kind of thing that you really want to deal with constantly, sort of being on the phone to company. So she passed it over to her partner and said, look, can you deal with this now, please? I'm fed up. Fair enough. So he sort of took up the charge and just more of the same, really. Tried to book appointments, didn't get appointments booked, getting sort of progressively angry with them. I think the last straw was when they did finally get booked into a garage, but they said they couldn't fix it because they only replaced tires. And they also
A garage only replaces tires.
Yeah, I mean,
that was niche.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I mean, I think that, you know, that's the thing. Probably, really? Again, not a car expert, but not great for Cinch. And also in this time, the car had also developed a couple of other faults. So hazard light came on and a couple of the charger in the front stopped working. So generally just not a great car. So they got in touch with me, and the other thing that's quite sort of amused me about this is the Cinch's slogan. So you might have seen their TV adverts back that advertised by Ryan Essex, Cheapy Chappy from X Factor and Big Brother.
Amazing teeth.
Muppet Sweep. And yeah, although
very
I read
tight he's skin.
Had his teeth kind of de-whitened. So he's now having really white teeth. But they were like too white. So now he's got some slightly less white teeth put on.
Got it. Okay.
Ryland's
by the by.
Over. But they're also their slogan, Cinch, is cars without the faff, which, I mean, that's not really what's happening. They've had almost nothing but faff, I would argue. So they got in touch with me and I got straight on to Cinch and said, come on, sort this out, please. And luckily they did. A couple of days later, they got it booked into a garage, which existed and did things other than change tyres. And a couple of days later, sorted. They gave her a courtesy car as well, which they hadn't done previously when the car wasn't working properly. So within a week, turned around back to them, and they also refunded them the admin fee that they paid to Cinch when they bought the car. So all in all, yeah, quite a good outcome. But I've actually since had a couple of other emails with people who've had problems with Cinch. So if anyone else has had any, then do drop me a line.
Well, it is a good outcome, but it's always the case when you tell me these stories that I think, okay, marvellous. But you do have the weight of who you are and who you work for behind you. So how can we normal folk sort this out without having to work for This Is Money? What did Cinch say? Are they going to change their practices more generally for people, or?
So they told me that this lady received a call from someone at Cinch, their chief customer officer, and she said that there are issues with the after-sales service and they plan to address them. What that means, I don't quite know, but I would hope that, you know, they do kind of buck their ideas up a bit on this, because once you've already bought the car, and I think you see this a lot with companies. Once you've already paid them the money, they care a lot less about how they treat you as a customer. And you're right, it is difficult as an individual to get a company to kind of take action. You know, in a way, they did all the right things. They kept calling them, they kept following up. And I agree, you know, in some stories, what else can you really do? They tried to lodge a complaint and the company said they didn't receive it. But, you know, I would always suggest to people that's one of the first things to do if your issue isn't getting addressed. You know, call them and say, I want to make this a formal complaint. That quite often works. But obviously, if the company doesn't get it for whatever reason, that's not really going to work. The other things I sometimes advise, try and get in touch with the chief executive directly if you can. Sometimes you can find their email address online or a phone number. Obviously, they're probably not going to call or email you back directly. But what that sometimes means is it gets passed on to a special complaints team, who are the sort of complaints head honchos, who often have more power to actually get things sorted out and sometimes pay you compensation. So that would be my other top tip. Also, if it's kind of a bit, some people say it's a bit tacky, but complain on social media, you know. It gets
It's the way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Send an angry tweet, send an angry Facebook message. I mean, why not? It's might as well. I would say, you know, if you're on it, why not? It can sometimes help them sort of pay attention to you. But it is difficult. You know, companies of all sorts need to be better at paying attention to their customers so that they don't have to ultimately get in touch with me.
Do you know, I have an idea, Helen. Not to add to your work pile, but you know how I introduce your section as Crane is back on the case. Well, I think you should do Crane on the case and then Crane is back on the case, or Crane returns to the case. Like, you say to that company, you say to Cinch, that's great, thank you very much. In 6 months' time, as you've read all my other articles, I will be coming back to you and monitoring you over the 6 months, and I will see exactly what you've been doing in that time. And I will be checking all of the comments that people make on social media and the reviews and seeing if you have improved. So I look forward to seeing you in 6 months' time. Simon, you can have that as a feature idea. It's yours, Crane.
That's an excellent idea.
Back on the case. So it's a bit of a threatening, that's okay, yeah, I'll take that. But for the rest of our readers, I'll be back in 6 months.
Yeah, I'll be watching your Trustpilot review score every single day. I'll make a graph.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, good shout. Happy to take it on.
Do it. Simon?
I mean, as possibly the closest thing to a motoring expert involved in this conversation.
So you know what a bonnet does,
right? I know probably a bit more about cars than you both. I mean, I've got a battery clamp for mine sitting on the side in the kitchen at the moment.
Don't even know what that is.
Yeah, exactly. My wife picked it up the other day. She's like, what is this? Is this part of your car? I was like, yeah. She's like, why is it on the side in the kitchen? I was like, oh, it came off. I need to put it back on. It's still sitting on the side in the kitchen, actually. I haven't driven the car since.
Oh, right. I was going to say, is it needed in the car?
It attaches the battery.
Oh,
you attach the battery to the rest of the car through via the wiring. But
And it just fell off?
No. Took
it off.
It's an old car and there's an electrical drain on it. And so to stop the battery being drained while the car is parked up, I've got a quick release battery clip that you unclip and disconnect the battery. And the last time I did it, it quick released a bit too much and the clamp came away from the wiring. So the clamp is now sitting on the side of the kitchen and the car is sitting on the drive without the battery hopefully being drained. So I've achieved the aim, but I do need to reattach the two things back together. But in order to do that, I will need to open the bonnet.
Yeah.
And after I've opened the bonnet, I will need to close the bonnet. So I can confirm that bonnets opening and closing are a requirement on cars. It is something that we do need. And also there's another number, you know, with those other things that Helen said had gone wrong with this car. I think that what the person who wrote in is probably concerned about is that in technical terms, they may have bought a lemon here and they might be a bit worried that this car is a duffer. So I can see why they're not very happy about it. And I could see why a company that maintains that it sells you cars without the faff might be letting people down a bit here. So, yeah.
That's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us. And if you do have a question or a comment or anything related to the podcast, stick podcast at the start of the subject line so we can easily find it in our email inbox at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join in the debate in reader comments. Tell us what you think about the things that we've been talking about today.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost-effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.